Sam, they're saying, yeah, I think we probably need to turn my headphone volume down a little bit. Okay. Jenna, why don't you tell me, I'm hearing an echo too. All right.
We're echoing off of each other?
Well, are you still echoing? I just turned my headphone volume down and that maybe, that may do the trick for me as well.
Okay, let me see. Am I echoing? No, I think my echo's gone.
Okay. I'm sounding better too.
Okay.
tell me something mundane, like what you had for lunch, so that we can get levels on you.
Oh, sad. I missed lunch. I had a nauseating cab ride from uptown to downtown instead, in lieu of lunch.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. I've recovered.
Okay.
Paul gave me a nice cup of tea, so I'm all better.
Okay. Do you have any questions of me before we start?
Well, I guess just roughly what you think we'll cover. I mean, nothing in detail. I don't want to preempt anything, but just roughly think we'll talk mostly about the book or all kinds of topics in science. And actually, I forgot to ask that before.
I want to jump off the book, and
okay.
I love the book. I think it's fantastic,
and
there's a lot in there to talk about, and I suppose I want to. But I want to do this organically. I want to also delve a little bit deeper into the glimpses you give in the book of, you know, where you stand looking at all of this and how it changes you to think about this way. And I also just want to talk about, you know, the work you do and what you're discovering now.
Okay, sounds great.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Have you heard the show?
Excuse me. I'm sorry to say I haven't heard the show. You know, I'm a little technologically challenged at the moment.
Are you?
Both television and radio.
Okay. All right.
I'm listening to things online, but I will I will tune in. Well, I was checking out your website, and I saw some of the kinds of topics you were covering.
Yeah. I mean, I've interviewed George Ellis, and I saw him, that you mentioned him in your work, and Freeman Dyson, and lots of
pretty great people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and now I'm hearing a little bit of an echo still.
Oh, okay.
I wonder if at that end they could turn down the, or I guess if I move away a bit. Sam, how are we sounding?
Jenna, how is Kristen's level in your headphones?
Pretty good.
Sounds good. Does it sound loud? Or if I turn it down just a little, you're going to hear her? I could.
Yeah, I think
Let's try that and see if that helps her.
Okay. And you have young children, don't you?
Yeah,
right?
I have a 4-year-old and a 15-month-old.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So I want to start with a question about childhood, which may be even more resonant for you since you're living with children.
Okay.
Sam, can we start? Are we rolling? Okay. Just that, you know, many people talk about childhood as a time when we all start to ask, for the first time, we ask these great existential questions. You know, even Einstein talked about childhood as a time when he posed some of the big questions that he then refined and delved into the rest of his life. And, you know, it seems to me that the field of cosmology is really so rich with, you know, in some ways with these grand existential questions, like how did this all happen? How did we get here? And I just wonder if you look back to your childhood, can you trace your curiosity in a rudimentary form to some of the things that fascinate you now?
Oh, absolutely. I remember asking questions like that about the origin of the universe and what we were doing here and what it meant to be part of the cosmos. I didn't think I would go on to be a scientist. In fact, I started as a philosophy major in college.
Right.
And I was very negative about physics, especially. I had no physics experience whatsoever, but I had this kind of comical stereotype of physicists memorizing things and being kind of rote. And I thought philosophy was after the big questions.
Right.
And it's very ironic when I look back at my childhood that I was absolutely mesmerized by cosmology and astronomy, even evolutionary science, ideas of natural selection. They had always captured my imagination and were these gratifying sort of ways to think about the world, even if I didn't always understand the answers. It was sort of really a way to think about the world.
Was there science being discussed in your home?
Yeah, my father is an MD, and he, for a few years, was doing research science, medical research, and he always talked a lot about sort of scientific explanations for things. You couldn't, you know, say you smelled something without it being a discussion about the molecules, and, you know, the neurons firing and how neurons worked. And so it was kind of a natural way to talk in the house, although, again, I didn't over-analyze that as a child. My mother was very literary and read lots of books and was not at all scientifically inclined. So mm-hmm. I didn't sense that my house had a sort of predominantly science approach.
Was there a religious background?
No.
No. Okay.
You know, in a sense, my grandparents were, I shouldn't say no so abruptly. My grandparents were immigrants, Jewish immigrants from Europe and Eastern Europe. And they grew up with a strong religious tradition. And my parents grew up speaking Yiddish. And my grandparents kept kosher until later in their lives when they kind of gave that up. So there was a sense of tradition, very strong tradition, and a very strong sense of our European history and our Jewish history. But I myself was never brought to temple. And I didn't have a bat mitzvah, and I didn't practice Judaism, actually, okay. I would have to say.
And, I mean, tell me how you made that transition. When you went to college and you were studying philosophy, how did you get captured by theoretical physics?
It's funny. I was asked to write something about that recently, so it's sort of fresh in my mind, okay. Revisiting that time. And I was sort of in denial, I think, about my interest in science. Even though I was a philosophy major, you have to take one science requirement. But I kept taking science requirements. Right. So I kept going. I kept taking chemistry, and then I took organic chemistry, and I started taking calculus. And I think I hadn't really admitted to myself that I actually loved science. And then I was in a philosophy class, and I was sort of impressed with the subject. We were talking about a lot of interesting things, free will and determinism, what it means to say we're free in a world that's completely causally physically determined. And there were all these very deep questions. And one day a scientist came in to give a guest lecture, and they started to discuss something about quantum mechanics. And everybody in the room got very quiet, and they discussed things about Einstein. Right. And what I was most impressed with is that philosophers didn't know how to respond. So I thought it was powerful, and I became interested in physics.
Well, and I think that this book you've written about Kurt Gödel and Alan Turing, you know, in many ways is very much takes place very much at that intersection where philosophical questions meet scientific inquiry and scientific truth.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, I definitely came back around again.
Did you?
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, I came full circle again to start asking those philosophical questions, I think.
I mean, because this kind of, this basic question, I mean, let's start with Kurt Gödel about truth, right? And I mean, I want you to put this into your own words, because I can't say that I can completely wrap my mind around it, but I'm utterly intrigued with it. You know, that truth... would ultimately elude us, that some mathematical truths can't be proven within the realm of mathematics, which doesn't necessarily mean they're not true, right?
Yes, that's right.
But that mathematics itself can't demonstrate their truth.
Yeah, that's right. It was a time in history when most mathematicians, I think it would be fair to say, believed that mathematics could address every mathematical proposition. And that's a fair enough thing to believe in retrospect. Why shouldn't mathematics be able to prove every true mathematical fact? Mm-hmm. So when Gödel came along and he found a very surreal kind of tangle, a mathematical proposition that makes a peculiar claim about itself, which cannot be proven within the context of arithmetic. It was in the context of arithmetic that he did this. It really shocked people. It really shook them up. And I think the way you said it is actually the clearest and nicest way to say it. There are some truths that can never be proven to be true. And it opens up this idea, which terrified people, that there are limits to what we can ever know.
And terrifying.
And it's not the first time it happened. If you think about Einstein's theory of special relativity, it was a similar idea. There are limits to how fast we can ever travel. We're limited by the speed of light. There are limits in quantum mechanics to how much we can ever really know. There are fundamental limits to certainty. Mm-hmm. And this all sort of happened around the same period of time that we began to accept this.
And, you know, there's a scene in the book you... I'm sure I'll be setting this up in the radio show, but, you know, basically you tell the stories of Kurt Gödel and Alan Turing kind of in parallel. Although they didn't meet, but their stories intersected and some of the people who influenced them and who they influenced intersected. And you have a lot of scenes with Gödel in Vienna. early 1930s Vienna in a coffee house and a famous kind of intellectual gathering, which was called the Vienna Circle. And there's a scene where you have, this mathematician, Olga Hahn Neurath, and her husband, Otto, who's a socialist. And I mean, these are just some of the people. Moritz Schlick was a philosopher and a logician who kind of headed this. And they often just come back to Wittgenstein's premise, his first premise in his famous Tractatus, that the world is all that is the case, which is a statement about some, you know, a basic thing that we can know as real. And you have this moment where Gödel challenges this, and he's been thinking about this and coming up with this theory that you described. And I have to say, you know, in the story, in the novel, all the members of this circle who are sitting at the table with him start to question almost whether they themselves are real, whether the person who's sitting across the table from them is real. And as a reader, I had that same experience. And I
that's beautiful.
It's wonderful. And so, I mean, I wonder if you would kind of describe that scene the way you envisioned it and what's happening there for you.
Well, I really hoped that the reader would have that experience, because ultimately I think that's where the book nudges. Do you know that any of this is real, that the book isn't a figment of your imagination?
Even the book itself, right?
The book itself, that somehow you aren't the author of the book itself. And, and so I was definitely pushing on that limit of what do we know and what don't we know? What do we take to be faith? What's rational to believe? What's not rational to believe?
And what is it that he says, and how is it that it is so shattering, you know, to them and to us?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. There's a little twist there, which is that Gödel, even though he proved something which is absolutely correct about mathematics, had beliefs which most people do not take to be true and struggle with.
Right.
So his mathematics is confirmed and everyone agrees was tremendous. And yet when we look at his ideas about the transmigration of the soul and his ideas about external reality being questionable, he really was suspicious about an external reality. The only reality he trusted was the mathematical reality he could kind of probe logically.
Numbers were more real than possibly the person sitting across the table from me.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. He believed that numbers were more convincingly real than the idea that the sun was real when you couldn't see it anymore after it had set. And so his idea about an empirical reality was strange. He wasn't sure he could believe in it. And most people, I think, aren't struggling with those issues, and so find it hard to follow Gödel down that path.
Mm-hmm.
And yet his mathematics was absolutely sound and shattering. And I think at some stage I realized that what I was writing about wasn't so much mathematics. What I was really writing about, which I think you've struck on, is belief. Mm-hmm. What Gödel believed, what the people in the Vienna Circle believed, how they all ultimately struggled with different ideas about reality. And there's this sort of surreal vagueness to our conclusions.
You know, you write of both Gödel and Turing that that they were besotted with mathematics. And I have to say that I feel that you, I don't know if you're completely like them in that way, but that you have a real sympathy for that, you know, the way you seem to delight in just in the way they live with mathematics and wrestle with it. And I mean, is that true? I mean, for you, are numbers maybe not more real than the sun and the earth, but as real as the sun and the earth? And you know, if so, what does that mean exactly? How would you explain that?
Well, I would absolutely say I am also besotted with mathematics. Mm-hmm. I don't worry about what's real and not real in the way that maybe Gödel did. I think what Turing did, which was so beautiful, was to have a very practical approach to answering these questions, so that he didn't get lost in philosophical absolutes or even philosophical vagaries. He believed that that life was sort of in a way simple, and you could relate to mathematics in a concrete and practical way, and it wasn't all about surreal abstract theories. And that's why Turing is the one who invents the computer, because he thinks so practically. He can imagine a machine which adds and subtracts, a machine which performs the mathematical operations that the mind performs. And so he really imagines a mind that's mechanized in an electromechanical kind of computer. And then he makes it, you know, essentially a reality. And the modern computers that we have now are these very practical machines that are built on those ideas. And so I would say that, like Turing, I am absolutely struck with the power of mathematics, and that's why I'm a theoretical physicist. If I want to answer questions, I love that we can all share the mathematical answers. It's not about me trying to convince you of what I believe or of my perspective or of my sort of assumptions. We can all agree that 1 plus 1 is 2, and we can all make calculations that come out to be the same, whether you're from India or Pakistan or, you know, Oklahoma.
Right.
We all have that in common. And so there's something about that that's deeply moving to me. And that makes mathematics pure and special. And yet I'm able to have a more practical attitude about it, which is that, well, we can build machines this way. And there is a physical reality that we can relate to using mathematics.
But Turing also, in his own way, explored the limits of our ability to know and prove what is true, didn't he? I mean, is that a fair statement?
Yes. He went beyond Gödel even and realized that, in a sense, most numbers aren't numbers about which we can know anything. And that seems very confusing. It seems like we know a lot of numbers.
Right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It seems like we know infinite lists of numbers. What Turing showed is that there are numbers which are so long, if I imagine them as a decimal point with a list of digits, that that list of digits is infinite and essentially random. And there are numbers about which we will never know anything. And it leads to very strange things, which even sometimes I think about in my own research, which is, are those numbers real in any sense, or are they just a mathematical construction? Is there no physical object which will ever be described by such what he called uncomputable number?
Hmm. I was very interested also that you wrote that even, I mean, Turing is known as the father of modern computing, and yet, of course, many people and developments played into that, into what we have today. You wrote, though, that he wanted to design machines that could think. And for him, even, in that very early stage, he wasn't just talking about computers that would have knowledge programmed in that would be able to play chess, which is, in fact, the way the field of artificial intelligence really began in many ways, really was for a few decades. Mm-hmm. But he actually had the vision towards which a lot of artificial intelligence, I know, at MIT is moving, which is what we want to do is create computers that can think, that can learn the way human beings learn. I wonder if you had any thoughts about why that, about that, you know, that development, that contradiction in what he believed and then the way the field developed.
Well, there is a really interesting point that can be found in a way in their discoveries. So if you think of mathematics as a rigid system where you have some rules and you start at some starting point and you always follow those rules to generate theorems, that is essentially what a formal mathematical system is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can prove that there are true facts that can never be reached by such a formal process, then any computer that you program in that way by just teaching it a handful of rules, no matter how many rules you do teach it, well, it will only be able to do a certain limited number of things. It can never prove these kinds of unprovable statements, fine. But the difference between the human mind is I can recognize the truth of a statement even if I can't prove it. And that is something that I can't do if I only program a rigid system to follow rigid rules. And so our minds seem to be doing something that's different than what a formal mathematical system does. And so it's very rooted in their theories, the things that both Gödel and Turing proved, that if I only program a computer in this way, I can never get it to do the things that a mind can do. And they knew that. I think Gödel said that he imagined an artificial intelligence evolving, not so much being programmed.
Right.
And that's, in a sense, how the human mind develops. Maybe there are simple rules that it's following, but the evolution becomes so complex that no one person could have sat down and coded it. It had to have become a very complex process that evolved in a very complex way to evolve a complex intelligence.
Hmm.
And so I think one of the interesting ideas in artificial intelligence is to try to do something similarly, start a digital organism, so to speak, and a digital ecology and see if you can't evolve an intelligence.
And it is true, I think you mentioned that that Gödel believed in the transmigration of souls, but Turing, by contrast, lost a faith that he did have early in life, and he really came to think of us as human beings as kind of biological machines.
Yeah, I think that was a very important moment for Turing, and I tried to describe it very sympathetically. I think there's a lot of feeling that if somebody loses their religious faith, that it would be this dark and horrible moment. It could only be associated with a kind of tragedy or despair. And I wanted to describe his as being a beautiful moment for him, because he had been grappling with such inconsistency between his logical naturalist approach to the world, which was verifiable, which he really did deeply relate to, which was everything to him, and his religious disposition, which wasn't gelling with the former, with this naturalist approach. And he just couldn't get them together. And I think there was a constant rub and feeling of discomfort and struggle with it. And when he accepted a more materialist approach in the sense of there is just nature, there's just mathematics, there's just this sort of organic reality, that he became freer and happier, and his life became easier. And it was a beautiful moment for him.
But it was also beautiful, I sense, because mathematics itself, I mean, what he did consider to be real and true, had almost a kind of transcendent quality.
Yeah, I think that that's true. What the kinds of questions he was approaching and the things he was thinking about were meaningful. And so I think that's another thing I really wanted to convey, is that it wasn't this meaningless moment of there's nothing and there's no meaning and there's no purpose and it's all darkness. It was really quite the opposite. He was getting a lot of meaning from his mathematical approach to the world. He was getting his sense of connectedness, his sense of purpose. So all those things that he had originally maybe been looking for in religion, he was finding in his science.
Right. And, you know, initially you mentioned the word beauty. And I have to say that something that's always fascinated me in conversation with scientists, and I'm thinking of George Ellis, the cosmologist, as one example where I really can hear his voice again, that beauty, the beauty of a mathematical equation.
Yeah. It's funny. I think the scientists are the last ones to get away with talking about beauty. I don't think artists with a straight face can really talk about beauty anymore. It's not chic.
Right.
And not even writers can talk about beauty. It seems corny. And so only scientists can, with a straight face, talk about things being beautiful, being seriously motivated by aesthetics, and having it actually pan out. I mean, that's quite remarkable, is that people have literally pursued theories because they're more beautiful and more elegant, and they make predictions that are later verified in experiments. So it's a fascinating question. Why is beauty an actually good way of devising our ideas about the universe? Why are they confirmed by nature? Why does nature choose beautiful ways of unraveling?
And I mean, you know, just, you know, echoing what we were speaking about earlier on about, you know, truth and, you know, getting back to Gödel and Turing. I mean, I remember someone saying to me, and maybe it was George Ellis, maybe it was John Polkinghorne, the physicist, saying, you know, if an equation is not elegant and beautiful, it is likely not true.
Well, that does seem to be the case. I mean, you could say we can't recognize things that aren't beautiful, but it's really deeper than that. It's really deeper than saying, oh, I only picked out the pattern. Mm-hmm. You can imagine the particles of the universe falling into a symmetric pattern, as one particle physicist did, and one was missing from this beautiful symmetric arrangement, and he conjectured the existence of that particle, and lo and behold, it was confirmed. So it's really something more than just saying, oh, we can only pull out the pattern and we miss everything else.
I wonder, I know that you're a scientist, you've also written a novel, you are an artist, a visual artist.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
I've
had my experiments. I used to do a lot of visual arts, but I wouldn't have said I was an artist. It was more a hobby, and I have spent time in art schools as a scientist in residence or doing art critique, and I've written a lot for artists for various catalogs, for exhibits and that sort of and books and things.
I mean, you know, here's something else I know without understanding, that numbers, that mathematics is also in some deep way behind music and drawing and art, right?
Well, you can definitely make the case for music. I mean, clearly, musical scales are based on mathematical structures, and even the idea of a harmonic has a really easy description in mathematics, and some fundamental theories about the universe being really made up of strings and not particles is related to similar ideas about harmonics, that you can pluck on a fundamental string to create the whole spectrum of the universe that we see.
That's so fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. But again, you can get caught up in the idea of beauty when it's not verified experimentally. So we can sometimes become intoxicated with how beautiful an idea is and not be able to let it go, even if it isn't verified. So we have to keep ourselves in check, I think.
Didn't I see? Now, I was looking around, and I'm not sure I knew exactly where to look for your art. There was something I saw. Again, I was being technologically challenged in this case. I was having trouble getting something to size on my computer. I think it was a picture you had drawn. I believe this was on your website.
I did have some drawings in some contributions, but I should qualify those. So I've done a lot of drawing, but that's not probably what you were going to pull up on your website. You were probably on the website link that you had. I was probably... I think what you were linking to was a contribution to something called the Big Draw. The Big Draw is something they do in England, and I think they do it other places too, but it might be once a year now that they have a bunch of artists contribute drawings, and some are comic artists and illustrators,
and
David Hockney did some.
And this was more along those lines, wasn't it?
Well, I threw something in almost to be kind of not contentious, but just to kind of expand the conversation. So I threw in a piece of scratch paper from my calculations as my
That's
contribution. And they knew I could draw. I mean, I can technically draw. I could draw a figure or something, and I can do that. But I thought it would be silly for me when there are all these artists contributing their drawings. I thought what's more interesting is to discuss in that context what drawing and visual representation mean in the conversation of working out an idea, for instance. And a lot of contemporary art is also interested in process and exploring questions and not so much, again, pretty pictures. So I think really contemporary artists loved this, thought it was really funny that I threw in a piece of scratch paper and thought it was really beautiful. But that was probably the kind of drawing you were pulling up.
It was geometric shapes.
Yeah, so I was. It was from a piece of scratch paper when I was calculating something about the shape of the universe.
Yeah,
when we're imagining the universe in a series of sort of geometric tiles, and imagining the entire shape of space, basically, I think was what you pulled up.
But I mean that is maybe I'm wrong about this, but I see this also as a way of that's also mathematics, right? It's not arithmetic. It's not numbers, but it's.
Well, that's a very good question. People often ask me, what do you mean different kinds of math? I mean, if you're not used to thinking about it, it sounds funny. What do you mean there are different kinds of math? None of them contradict each other, but there are different branches of mathematics. Some literally deal with numbers and number theory, how numbers lay themselves out and what's hidden between 0 and 1. And you would not believe what's in there. It's quite fascinating what's in there. There's an array of infinite numbers, very beautiful. And then there's something completely different like topology, which has to do with the shape of spaces and the multi-connected possibilities of spaces. And there's all kinds of branches of mathematics.
And that's your field, isn't it, topology?
I've definitely used topology to ask questions about cosmology and the origin of the universe. So I talk to the mathematicians, the topologists who are making the discoveries, and we use those theories to imagine if our universe, for instance, is infinite or if it's finite. And if it's finite, what possible shapes could it have? And there's an infinite list of this sort of intriguing possibilities that arises. Mm-hmm. And we use the mathematics to sort through so that we're not limited by our eyes, which will fail us, and we're not limited by our intuitions, which would also fail us.
So, you know, so one thing that I'm one place this is taking my mind is, you know, mathematics being behind the kind of hardest logic, the kind of hardest logic or science that it seems human beings can conjure up and kind of show each other. And then mathematics in some way also being in the fabric, in the structure of art, which to me it conveys truths and or true kinds of truth that science and facts and logic cannot.
Well, it's interesting. Obviously, I'm very intrigued by art and the written word and things that you can do there that you can't do in a straightforward calculation. But they're different things. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, I really do believe that they are different things. They might be approaching the same question from different sides, but they're definitely approaching from different sides. So they don't give redundant or contradictory pictures. So, for instance, I often get letters from people saying, I have a theory of the universe, and it looks like this. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to explain what the difference is between saying, you know, I have a model, and it's an origami picture, and it looks like this, and there's time going in this direction, between that and between something that's really motivated in mathematics. And the mathematics is something, again, that we can all verify. It's not about a weird dream I had or some fantastical picture or some gut feeling or some feeling in my solar plexus. Mm-hmm. It's something that is absolutely unambiguous. And I can't, for instance, write a paper until I've done that kind of a calculation. Until my calculation is unambiguous and other people can check it, if I just have vague ideas or feelings about it, I can go years and not be able to write a paper on a subject. So there's a difference between what we feel about things and what we're doing really in science when we're calculating things mathematically. And so I really separate those things. When I'm doing science, I want it to be kind of raw and hard and
right.
Not at all flowery and rigid. And yet when I'm writing, I'm kind of going after the opposite. I want it to hit people in the solar plexus. I don't want them to walk away necessarily being able to recite a theorem. And I'm not even disappointed if they don't fully understand the mathematics. What I want them to get is a feeling for the stakes, a feeling for, as you said, how these people were besotted by mathematics itself, how moved they were by the subject, how much it brought them away from other people and away from reality, even as they were trying to understand reality and their place in the world. So I feel that they serve totally different purposes.
Well, right, but different purposes, but perhaps both important purposes. I mean, I also sense that you're pursuing questions, beliefs, I don't know, hunches about the meaning of life or just about what matters to you in a form that those calculations simply can't contain or convey, that simply can't be captured in those, in numbers.
You mean by writing a book?
Yeah, by writing a book. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Or being engaged with the arts.
Right,
or,
right.
Well, I think that's true. I think that the answers that we're going to get, the discoveries that we're going to make are going to be in mathematics. But they're going to be meaningless to us unless they're integrated into a sort of human perspective where mm-hmm. we understand why we ask the questions, what the significance of the answers is for us, and how the world is going to change as a result of having made those discoveries. Hmm. So I think that probably is true. I think that's why I can't quit one, become completely committed to the other.
Right.
I continue to sort of go back and forth between the two subjects.
I mean, I think that in many disciplines in Western culture, we are rediscovering the power of narrative, right? It's happening in journalism, it's happening in economics, it's happening in theology. And I feel like what you with this novel, A Madman Dreams of Turing Machines, you're talking about science narratively.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's another way of, you know, paraphrasing what you just said.
Well, I really wanted the book to be as much about language as anything else, as much about a visceral experience as anything else. I had considered writing a nonfiction book, but I just wanted to write something that was almost overwhelming in the actual experience of reading it, that would be almost maybe unnerving, and the language would be kind of over the top or hyper real or surreal. I'm not even sure which adjective is the right adjective.
Yeah.
And so that is all about the narrative, and that is all about writing a narrative. And it's not so much about the specifics of the science. The fact that science is my subject is just the way it is for me. You know, some people will always write about domestic relationships, and some people will always write about immigrants, and some people, you know, we write about the things that have shaped the way we view the world, because that's the way that, as authors, we're offering something, I think, unique and genuine. And so for me, I just can't get away from the fact that that is how I view the world. And that's what I have in common with these two crazy guys. It's why I have such sympathies for them. And even though I said, for instance, that Turing is the one in a way that I really do side with, I wanted to be very sympathetic in my representation of Gödel. And even of Wittgenstein, who may have been a mystic, that it's not a matter of who I think is right or wrong. It's I wanted to air their whole complete sort of view of the world.
No, as a cosmologist, I think you have a more detailed sense of the nature of time and space, and of how generous and fluid that is, in a way that, you know, I think, as opposed to what Einstein called the stubbornly persistent illusion that most of us have, that it's time is this arrow of past, present, and future. I wonder if you think that gives you kind of an advantage as a novelist. You know, that you, when you're writing about these philosophical, existential, mathematical conversations around a table in Vienna in 1930, you almost place yourself there, listening in on that conversation and taking part in it. And I wonder if you think maybe that's in some way more real to you because of your science.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it's not a hard barrier that I'm up against. In other words, to imagine time as completely linear or rigid or ticking in a kind of regular way. And I think the book is definitely parsed out in a way in which time is drawn out for one and collapsed for the other. And so there is this feeling that they're not experiencing the same passage of time, and the years are different, and one is coming up to 1952 at the same time the other one's coming up to the 70s. And and yet that should be natural. That shouldn't feel so jarring. You don't have to clock through, you know, in this rigid way. So maybe that's why I feel discomfort with it. It's possible. But I think that's right. The narrator in the book is kind of able to be atemporal and place herself in these various scenes, as is the reader. And there's this moment, again, where the reader is asked to be the narrator, to be the observer, to conjure this up in their own minds, to try to understand the truth as best they can, and to know that they will always be slightly to the side of the mark, that they will always kind of deform the truth under their own attempt to understand it.
So I want to pose a question to you that you pose in different ways to Turing and Gödel, or you have them contemplate in the novel. And I'll say it this way, you know, in your mind, does the fact that 1 + 1 = 2 have anything to do with God?
Are you asking me that question?
Yeah, I'm asking you that question.
Well,
I'm asking you how you think about it.
You're tough. I think that it raises, if I were to ever lean towards spiritual thinking or religious thinking, it would be in that way. It would be, why is it that there is this abstract mathematics that guides the universe? The universe is remarkable because we can understand it. That's what's remarkable. All the other things are remarkable too, but it's really, really astounding that these little creatures on this little planet that seem totally insignificant in the middle of nowhere, we're not special, we're not in a special place, can look back over the 14 billion year history of the universe and understand so much, and in such a short time. So I think that that is where I would get a sense, again, of meaning and of purpose and of beauty and of being integrated with the universe so that it doesn't feel hopeless and meaningless. Now, I don't personally invoke a god to do that, but I can't say that mathematics would disprove the existence of God either. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of those things where over and over again you come to that point where some people will make that leap and say, I believe that God initiated this and then stepped away and the rest was this beautiful mathematical unfolding. Mm. And others will say, well, as far back as it goes, it seems to be these mathematical structures and I don't feel a need to conjure up any other entity.
Right.
And I think I fall into that camp. And without feeling, again, despair or dissatisfaction. And yet I understand why other people make the other jump.
I sense that what you know about mathematics and the kinds of ideas that you spend your life with do leave you with a real nagging question about human freedom, about free will.
Absolutely.
Talk to me about that.
I think it's a difficult question to understand what it means to have free will if we are completely determined by the laws of physics. And even if we're not, because there are things, for instance, in quantum mechanics, which is the theory of physics on the highest energy scales, which imply that there's some kind of quantum randomness so that we're not completely determined. But randomness doesn't really help me either. So okay. Either I'm like
suggest to you that there's space for human decisions and for people to change the way things work, though? No?
I don't see how it does.
Okay.
You know, it just becomes, you know, if something randomly falls in a certain way, how is that a gesture of will? So it's either will has to do with determinism. My will strictly determines an outcome, or it doesn't. So it's very hard. There is no clear way, I don't think, of making sense of an idea of free will in a pinball game of strict determinism or in a game which has elements of random chance that are just sort of thrown in. Where does my will come in there? So it doesn't mean that there isn't a free will. I've often said maybe someday we'll just discover something. I mean, quantum mechanics was a surprise. General relativity was a surprise. The idea of curved space-time. Right. There are limits to mathematics. All of these great discoveries were great surprises, and we shouldn't decide ahead of time what is or isn't true. So it might be that this convincing feeling I have that I'm executing free will is actually because I'm observing something that is there. I just can't understand how it's there. Or it's a total illusion. It's just an illusion. It's a very, very convincing an illusion, you know, convincing illusion, but it's an illusion all the same.
Right. But, you know, then I wonder, I know I was pushing at this a minute ago, and, you know, then I wonder whether when you are writing beautiful language, writing fiction, you know, drawing pictures, listening to music, you know, whether those things don't, again, convey a reality as well. I mean, you say, so for you as a scientist, you said this convincing feeling, you simply can't take that as seriously as a calculation that you can prove. No matter what.
No, I can't. And no matter what, you know, our convincing feeling is that time is absolute. It is a very convincing feeling that time is absolute.
Right.
Our convincing feeling is that there should be no limit to how fast you can travel. You just go faster and faster and faster. Yeah. Our convincing feelings are based on our experiences because of the size that we are, literally, the speed at which we move, the fact that we evolved on a planet under a particular star. So our eyes, for instance, are peak in their perception at yellow, which is the wave bend the sun peaks at. And so it's not an accident that our perceptions and our physical environment are connected. And so we're limited also by that. That makes our intuitions excellent for ordinary things, for ordinary life. And that's how we evolve. That's how our brains evolved and our perceptions evolved, was to respond to things like the sun and the earth and these scales. And if we were quantum particles, we would think quantum mechanics was totally intuitive. And it's not intuitive for anybody else. But okay. We would think that things fluctuating in and out of existence or not being certain in their, you know, whether they're particles or waves or these kinds of strange things that come out of quantum theory would seem absolutely natural. And what would seem really bizarre is the kind of rigid, clear-cut world that we live in. So I guess my answer would be that our intuitions are based on our minds. Our minds are based on our neural structures. Our neural structures evolved on a planet under a sun with very specific conditions. So we reflect the physical world that we evolved from. So I guess the bottom line is that our intuitions are good. Our intuitions are good for a lot of things, and that's why they're good. It's not a miracle.
And so, I mean, as you have come to see things this way through your work as a scientist, I mean, do you live differently because of that? Do you raise your children differently because of that? Or is it just a puzzle that you hold, that you carry forward?
Oh, about free will.
Yeah.
The question about free will.
Uh-huh.
Okay, let me try again. So the lack, if I conclude that there's no free will, it doesn't mean that I should go run amok in the streets. It just doesn't follow to me as a logical possibility. I mean, I'm no more free to make that choice than I am to make any other choice. And so there's a practical notion of responsibility or civic free will that we uphold when we prosecute somebody or when we hold juries or when we pursue justice that I completely think is a practical notion that we should continue to pursue. And it doesn't make sense to say people will run through the streets, because if that's what they're going to do, then they're no more free to do that than we were to do otherwise. It's not one of responsibility. Mm-hmm. And it's not like I can choose to be irresponsible or responsible because I'm confused about free will. That's being even more confused than me. If you think you can choose to behave irresponsibly because free will doesn't exist, you are even more confused than I am about the existence of free will.
Okay. Well, maybe – I don't think this is an easier question, but maybe this question is maybe at another level, because another of these big existential questions that I think runs through your ruminations about – Gödel and Turing and the nature of truth and what we can know and what's real. Is there any point to all this? This great question about purpose. And so, mm-hmm. you know, again, I want to ask you, as from what you know as a scientist, how do you think about, is there purpose to the universe or to our lives, even if we don't have free will?
I certainly think that both Turing and Gödel are examples of people living out their purpose. Even though they came to tragic ends, those were people who were committed really to meaningful pursuits. And if you look at Turing, for instance, he was honest to the end. He really believed in being blunt and truthful. He couldn't pretend. He couldn't be a fake. He hated this idea of fakes and phonies. And he couldn't pretend to be somebody he wasn't. He couldn't pretend to be heterosexual, even if it meant imprisonment or lethal poisoning. And there is a person who, even though he might not have believed in free will, still behaved in a way that I think most people would hold up as being responsible for himself and believing in truth. And Gödel also, even though he went very astray in his sort of compulsions and his paranoia and his imaginings, was very committed to being truthful, in a sense, to really following logic where it led him and to not deceiving himself or taking an easier path. And so I think both of those are admirable examples of people living up to their innate purpose.
And they are they were brilliant human beings who, you know, actually contributed knowledge that that is valuable even today. I mean, especially Turing, I think we all live every single day with something that he helped make possible. Mm. And yet they both essentially committed suicide. And
they did both commit suicide, they both, essentially. It's true. I mean, it's sort of a vague kind of suicide, but they did.
But And yet, you know, even the way they died and the messiness of their lives as human beings, the difficulties of that is also kind of a testament to the strangeness of life and in some way, the ultimate failure of logic as a complete answer to this mm-hmm. other great existential question of what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was really Gödel who was most led down that path by pursuing logic to its end. He couldn't ever give up any bit of minutia because he had to go through every little step of every little thought process. Mm-hmm. And he definitely struggled with his ordinary life and committed suicide by self-starvation, really. I describe it, I think, as two competing forces. One is the will to live and one is the will to die. And it's sort of this constant balance between hypochondria and hurting himself right. with this abstemious, obsessive behavior. So you could look at him and say he could not get out of logic what he needed to be happier or more content in the world. And maybe that's true. And maybe some of the greatest minds are not the ones who are the happiest mm-hmm. and the most comfortable, who choose the easiest, most middle-class existence. I mean, we see that time and time again, that the heroes that we look back on made very painful, difficult choices, gave up physical comforts, gave up oftentimes wealth and other things in order to pursue something that they believed in. And maybe that was Gödel. He just pursued what he believed in to the end, even if none of us could understand where he went with that. Turing, on the other hand, I think was really betrayed by the culture that he helped to save. And so his case, I think, is different. I don't think Turing died because he was insane. He was not insane. I don't think Turing committed suicide because he was unable to cope with his mathematical notions. Mm-hmm. His mathematical notions, being much more practical, were actually quite healthy. And he was functioning in some ways internally, quite happily. Where he was not functioning that well was in his relationship to the society around him, mm-hmm. which rejected his homosexuality to the point of sentencing him to either imprisonment or hormonal castration and giving him 2 years of hormone treatments, which left him physically obese and depressed. So I think that his fight was not an internal struggle. It was really an external struggle.
And I guess, again, I'm curious about, you know, where you come out on that. And those are two extreme stories. And I do want to say that although there's real tragedy in them, I think you present them in a very human light. And we also see what was wonderful about these human beings and what they brought into the world. You know, so I don't want to say that, you know, here are these stories just of tragedy.
Right.
But I think a more kind of mundane question is, you know, mm-hmm. how does the messiness of just of experience, you know, of all of us, you know, not just our what we can know, but just how life unfolds, how does that impinge on kind of the ultimate reality of what we can know and achieve through logic and through science?
Well, I think that's a difficult question. I think that I myself would argue that we should never turn away from what nature has to show us, that we should never pretend we don't see it because it's too difficult to confront it. And I guess that's something that I don't understand about other attitudes that want to disregard certain discoveries because they don't gel with their beliefs. And one of the painful but beautiful things about being a scientist is being able to say it doesn't matter what I believe. I might believe that the universe is a certain age, but if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And there's something really, I think, thrilling about being committed to that. And so in my own life, I don't feel that causes me problems. I mean, I've also, in a lot of ways, made easier choices than my two heroes who I wrote about.
Right.
I do have children. They did not have children. I do have a certain sense of having a physical comfort around me that they don't have or didn't have. And in a way, I'm a much more connected person than either of those two people, even though I still have some of the affinities that they have. Maybe that means that I'll never go as far as they went in my own discoveries. I hope that's not the case, but I can imagine maybe it will be. And maybe there is a trade-off. Maybe sometimes you just have to abandon everything and pursue nothing but that. I'd like to think that if I'm lucky, I'll just get better at honing in on the jugular of things so that I can still make progress in discoveries as a scientist or have epiphanies as a writer. But I guess we all just have to find that particular balance.
You know, reading your book about two scientists kind of led me on this path of reading other biographies of scientists. So I've been reading James Gleick's biography of Newton, another
he's a great writer.
Very complicated character also. And something that reminds me of, I discover this again and again. I remember discovering this when we delved into Einstein, is, how what Newton discovered, it wasn't just important. It absolutely changed the way people thought about the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about, what are you working on right now that's probably not accessible to most of us? We don't even know that these kinds of discussions are taking place. So what are you working on that also, starts to reshape the way you see the world around you and the way you move through it?
Well, it's funny. People have often asked me when I've been describing the work that I'm doing, they'll say, well, why should I care about that? Mm-hmm. It's a fair question. Mm-hmm. Why should I really care about that? I'm telling something about extra dimensions and maybe the universe isn't three-dimensional, but maybe there are extra spatial dimensions that for some reason we're not aware of, but that have strong implications for how the universe is growing and evolving. And I've been working on these kinds of ideas a lot lately, and whether space is infinite or if it's finite, and if these extra dimensions are also finite and they're kind of curled up onto themselves. And it is very abstract. We could do a whole show hammering that out.
Yeah, yeah.
But supposing we grasp the notion of multidimensional space and spaces that are finite, people say, why should I care about that? My taxes are high, we have a war in Iraq. And these are fair questions. But my feeling is that it changes the world in such a fundamental way. We cannot begin to comprehend the consequences of living in a world after we know certain things about it. I think we cannot imagine the mindset of somebody pre-Copernicus when we thought that the Earth was the center of the universe and that the sun and all the celestial bodies orbited us. And I think that once you make that shift, that we are not at the center of the solar system, it's really not that huge a discovery in retrospect. In retrospect, so we orbit around the sun, we take this to be commonplace, and there's lots of planets in our solar system, and the sun is just one star out of billions or hundreds of billions in our galaxy, and there are hundreds of billions of galaxies. And we become, little dust motes in the scheme of things. That shift is so colossal in terms of what it did, I think, to our world, our global culture, our worldview, that I can't begin to draw simple lines to say this is what happened because of it or that's what happened because of it. We see ourselves differently, and then we see the whole world differently. And we begin to think about meaning and all of these questions that you've brought up completely differently than we did before. And I feel the same way if we discover that the universe is finite or if we discover that there are additional spatial dimensions. These things will impact us, I think, in ways that we can't just draw simple cause and effect arrows.
And I mean, does it make you react to simple things differently in your life? Because you are closer to, that cutting edge of knowledge right now.
Well, I think I will often look at what people feel is very important and not identify with what they think is very important. I think that's probably true. I have a hard time becoming obsessed with internal social norms, how you're supposed to dress or wear your tie or who's supposed to. For me, it's so absurd because it's so small and it's so this funny thing that this one species is acting out on this tiny planet in this huge vast cosmos. So I think it is sometimes hard for me to participate in certain values that I think other people have. So in that sense, I guess there is a shift of what I think is significant and what I think isn't. And if I try to look at that closely, I would say the split that is things that are totally constructed by human beings, I have a hard time taking seriously. Hmm. And things that seem to be natural phenomena that happen universally, I seem to take more seriously.
Well, give me an example. I mean, I think sometimes it's hard to draw the line. Give me an example of something for you that would be totally humanly constructed and then the other.
Well, let's see.
Aside from dress codes.
Right. Well, you know, actually, this is going to sound really dangerous, but even things like who we elect as an official in our government. Of course, I take very seriously our voting process, and I'm try to be politically conscious. But sometimes when I think about it, I have to laugh that we're all just agreeing to respect this agreement that this person has been elected for something. And that is really a totally human construct. Like, we could turn around tomorrow and all choose to behave differently. We're animals that organize in a certain way. And I think it is funny to see us behave as animals who are organizing in a certain way sometimes. Mm. So it's not that I completely dismiss it or don't take it seriously. But I think a lot of the things we are acting out are these animalistic things that are that are consequences of our sort of what's the word? Our not just innate but kind of our instincts, and they aren't in some sense as meaningful to me as the things that will live on after our species comes and goes. Does that make any sense?
No, it does. It makes a lot of sense. It's perspective that you bring, that you have. Yeah. It's different. That's a bit larger. That's cosmic.
And it doesn't mean that I'm dismissing things as unimportant either. You know, I take very seriously what's going on in the world right now, and I'm really pained by what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. But my perspective is to look at it as just as animals acting out ruthless instincts and unable to control themselves, even though other people think that they're being very heady and intellectual.
So, I mean, I do believe, and I think I know this, that human beings have this longing to, that something deep is met in human beings in a sense of being part of something larger than oneself, being part of something big.
Well, I think we are part of something larger than ourselves.
Right, I think we know
that for sure. And it's a remarkable thing to know that for sure. We definitely are made up of material that was synthesized in the cores of stars, a previous generation of stars. I mean, we literally are made up of something larger than us. You know, we come from a very specific series of events in this universe that if they hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here.
But I think some people might listen to this and feel that if you really internalize this, that possibly everything is predetermined, that we in fact are not free in any way, that we are behaving like animals even when we think we're at our most civilized, you know, that life would somehow be robbed of joy and hope and transcendence. Mm-hmm. I don't experience you as a person without joy, hope, and transcendence. But I mean,
I don't feel that way at all. I have a 15-month-old daughter and a 4-year-old son, and the overwhelming feelings I have for them, even if I believe that their instinct, do not fade one bit because of that. It matters to me not at all that I have evolved to feel that way. It doesn't take anything away from me whatsoever. That feeling is as real, as strong, as beautiful, as meaningful as it is for somebody who believes otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I've never really understood the argument that it takes the shine off of things, when for me it really doesn't take the shine off of things. For instance, let's say somebody said that they had a belief system in which it was simply posited that carbon came out of, I don't know, a blue sky one day. That wouldn't make me feel any more meaning about who I was in the world. It feels much richer to me to imagine that a cold, empty cosmos collapses with stars, and stars burn and shine, and they make carbon in the cores, and then they throw them out again, and that carbon collects and forms another planet, another star, and amino acids evolve, and then human beings arise. I mean, that's, to me, a really beautiful narrative. Mm. And I don't feel that I lose any of those rich experiences by following it. Mm.
It seems to me that there's so much beguiling kind of mystery in science right now. I mean, even language like dark dark matter. What is it? It's dark matter. Dark. What's the other?
We can be pretty corny too. You know? There's all kinds of acronyms.
Right. But it's so. I mean, it's certainly it is very, very mysterious. Whether that implies, you know, the way, whether that's the same way religious people talk about mystery or not. There's real mm-hmm. mystery in it. Isn't that right? I mean.
Well, I think the secret you are uncovering is that scientists often share a very childlike wonder for the world. And so a lot of the language that we invent about the universe reflects that kind of childlike experience. So there is really, at some level, that feeling of excitement over learning about the universe and wanting it to sound a certain way, you know, wanting the language to reflect the mystery and the magnitude of what we're learning. So I think that's what you're picking up on.
And even, I mean, the more we learn, and as you said, we know so much, but there's so much, you also realize how much we have yet to discover.
That's right. I don't know that it will ever end. I mean, I think if we really believe that we will know everything and that scientists will be out of work, that would be kind of depressing for me too. And on the other hand, if I really think I'm pursuing real answers to questions, you might hope that you come to the end one day. And there's a sort of funny balance in your own desires for things. You want to make great discoveries, but somehow you don't want the mysteries to ever end. You know, it's like a great book. You don't ever want to come to the end.
Right.
And we might never come to the end. Maybe we'll keep learning things, real things, making strides, but we will find more behind that one point or that last, you know, sort of dark mist, and we'll learn more beyond that. I don't think anyone really knows how that will pan out.
I just want to ask you a couple more questions. I know we need to finish.
Sure.
But I know that you're now working on the idea of whether the universe is infinite or finite, and somewhat against the grain, you are pondering whether the universe is finite. Explain that to me. And that's that question you say you get asked. What might that matter to any of the rest of us?
Right. Well, there are a handful of people for several years ago who started getting interested in this around the world. And I think it sort of sounds less outlandish now than it used to. I think people more and more realize that it's a tenable possibility that the universe is finite. And we just don't know the answer to that question. And what it would mean is it's similar to the idea of the Earth. If you're standing, as I am, in New York City, and you walk in a straight line, and then you swim in a straight line, and then you walk again and swim again, and you keep going in a straight line as far as you possibly can go, you will end up coming back to New York City. Because the Earth is not infinite. It is also it doesn't have an edge off of which you would just sort of fall off. So the Earth is compact, finite, and edgeless. And we're imagining something like this for the entire three-dimensional space in which we live. It's a little harder to visualize because people want to bend it into four dimensions and think of it as a surface. And it gets a little visually confusing. Mm-hmm. But instead of trying to do all of that, stand outside the universe looking in on it, which you can never do, I think it's better to imagine being in the universe. And like in the Earth example, walking around the Earth, if you imagine getting into a rocket and flying out into space and never turning left or right, traveling in as straight a line as you possibly can in your rocket ship, eventually, if the universe is finite, it's conceivable you will come back to where you started.
Because it would be curved. It would be curved.
It's being curved and wrapping back on itself, just like the Earth. The Earth isn't just curved, because it could be curved and lumpy and still have an edge. Mm-hmm. It could be curved and lumpy and still be infinite. But it actually wraps back onto itself. Mm-hmm. I can travel in lots of different directions and still come back to New York City. I can go, I could go to Canada and I'd still come back to New York City. And so in space-time, it might be something like that. I travel in a rocket ship in several different directions and I find myself coming back to where I started. I think I left the Earth behind me. I see it go away behind me. And as I approach some planet in front of me, I realize, whoa, that's the Earth again. And this idea is rooted in as we talked about, the mathematics of topology. And I haven't actually been working on that so much lately because I've turned a little bit more to the extra dimensions, although it's a very similar idea. If extra dimensions are also wrapped up in finite, we're also using topology to understand their shape and the consequences their shape might have on the shape of the large universe that we observe. So I'm trying to understand now if we can know about the universe being finite or infinite by looking at the small dimensions. So it's a kind of indirect approach.
And you've made this interesting observation that several times in history, when science has acknowledged limits, right? You know, you'd be putting finitude to infinity, that in mm-hmm. fact has made great leaps forward possible.
Yes, it's a funny thing. It doesn't mean that we throw up our hands and say we can't know anything. You know, mathematics has limits. Oh, no, we don't do mathematics anymore, or the speed of light is a fundamental limit. We stop doing physics. It's really been exactly the opposite. Mathematics has limits, and somehow that leads people to invent a computer. Mm-hmm. The speed of light has a finite limit, which is what Einstein proposed, and he invents special relativity and eventually a theory of curved space-time based on this observation. So it opens up this huge way of thinking about the world when we kind of accept our limits and just move on. And quantum mechanics was the other example where quantum mechanics implies a fundamental uncertainty in what we can know about physical reality. And by accepting this, we make these enormous discoveries.
Right.
So I think similarly, if we come to accept that maybe the universe isn't infinite, I mean, Einstein had this funny thing, which I'm probably overusing because I've said a bunch of times, but he said only two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. And then he said, I'm not so sure about the universe. So he knew that it was conceivable that the universe wasn't infinite, but he wasn't sure how to go about it. And that mathematics didn't come until later. And only later did we understand how to kind of actually handle it. And if we were to discover that the universe was finite, I think it would again be something like what happened with Copernicus, or like understanding that there was a Big Bang. I think it's hard for us to remember what it was like before the discovery of the Big Bang itself. That's just such a part of our worldview now.
That there was a beginning point.
There was a beginning, that mm-hmm. the universe hasn't always been here, that it isn't permanent mm-hmm. and unending and unalterable.
And, you know, and there's such, we're talking, you're talking at such a lofty level, but there's such interesting resonance with just, you know, maybe these tawdry intuitions that we have. But, I mean, you know, that kind of what we can know about life, and that limits also are liberating at this mm-hmm. kind of daily level that we inhabit.
Well, I don't want to be too dismissive of intuitions. I mm-hmm. say every physicist goes on their intuition. They just don't say that their intuition is the be-all and the end-all. They use their intuition, and then sometimes they find out they're wrong. Mm-hmm. You accept that, and you move on, you know. Yeah. And that's half the fun. It's kind of saying, wow, it's really not what I expected. But that's part of the honesty of what you're doing as a scientist, is you're not imposing your beliefs on the world. You might use them to guide you, just like we all do our best, you know, the best to use our intuitions to guide us. Mm-hmm. But you have to be able to you know, throw your hands up and say when you're wrong.
Right. And I just want to come back just finally to something that this is a nuance of, we spoke at the very beginning about Kurt Gödel, this scientist who, one of the two scientists you wrote about in your novel. And So just bear with me as I try to. He said there are things that are true that mathematics, there are things that mathematics cannot prove. They might still be true, but the idea was you would have to go outside mathematics to know that. Mm-hmm. And you use phrases like, you know, that we can't see them until we step out. In fact, we can't see the logic of them until we step outside the logical framework. You said something like, we have to look at them out of the corner of our eye.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that again seems so resonant with life as I know it. And I just, you know, I wonder how, if that's a kind of idea that you also find you can translate into other aspects of knowledge and experience.
Well, I definitely think it's the reason the book was structured as a novel. If you look at the book, I try to stick as close to fact as possible. It's not the facts that I'm changing. It's the approach to the facts, and it's a sort of confession that no matter how I list these facts, I am somehow not able to get at the truth. The truth doesn't just drop out like a theorem if I follow certain logical steps. Mm. And I think it's really the whole idea of structuring the book that way. And I think maybe it's saying something also about maybe my own approach to science. No matter how much I follow these logical steps, no matter how much I make real discoveries that will be unambiguous, I hope. there, in some sense, my approach to the truth in the bigger a sense of the meaning of the word will always be a little bit out of the corner of my eye. What it or the visceral experience of what it really means or what the implications are. Mm. And so I did want the reader to have this sense that there are no true things, really, except for things as crisp as 1 plus 1 equals 2, that are unambiguously true. Right. And yet we know we're getting closer to the truth, even though we can't always prove it.
Mm. That's great. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. I did, too.
Thank you. I don't think we're going to be able to put this on the air until after the first of the year, but we'll be in touch with you about that.
Okay, sure. Is this edited down?
Yeah, it's edited down for an hour of radio.
Is there anything that you wanted to go back over that we might have been clumsy on?
No, it was great.
Okay,
It's a real conversation. It was wonderful.
Okay, you do great research. I'm really impressed with how well you researched.
Thank you. Well, I love these ideas, and again, I just really loved your book, and I'm going to give it a big recommendation.
Oh, thanks so much.
And
it's really great.
We'll be in touch, and we may have some other questions, even about we layer the show with readings and music, and we might even ask your advice about some of that closer to the time.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Okay.
So thanks for making the time, and thanks for your work.
Yeah, it was good to talk, and I'll be sure to listen to the show.
Okay, now. 7 o'clock, 7 o'clock Saturday morning. That's when it's on in New York City.
I'm up, sadly. I'm up.
Well, I know. Actually, we have a lot of listeners with young children at that time.
Right, exactly.
All right.
It's on Sunday night, too, in New York.
Yeah, it's on Sunday night at 10.
Oh, okay.
It's also on Saturday afternoon at 3, but it's on all different places. Okay.
I'm more likely to be awake at 7 than at 10 at night.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.